Today is the 70th anniversary of the Japanese attack that brought the U.S. into World War II. This week at Pearl Harbor, five memorials were held for servicemen who lived through that assault and requested that their remains be interred where shipmates are still entombed in sunken ships. They are part of the sad archaeology of World War II, which has been exhaustively documented in news programs, documentaries, and feature films.
The noise that you hear at the moment is the sound of the air raid siren. I'm standing here just on the steps of St. Martin's in the Fields.
Their orders come from Hirohito himself. Saipan must not fall.
Did you say the first tunnel?
I did. There'll be three. We'll call them Tom, Dick, and Harry. Tom, as I said, goes out directly east from 104. Dick goes north from the kitchen. And Harry goes out parallel to Tom from 105. If the goons find one, we'll move into the other.
We just heard to start Edward R. Murrow in London, G.I. Diary, narrated by Lloyd Bridges, and then a scene from The Great Escape, the film based on the book, based on the real-life escape of 76 prisoners who broke out of the real German POW camp. How did they breathe when they ran down those tunnels? Well, with the help of a ventilation system made out of milk tins. How do we know that? Archaeology. Samir Patel is the deputy editor of Archaeology magazine. He and his colleagues have put together a review of some recent work in the archaeology of World War II. And Samir joins us from the studios of WNYC in New York. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So what kind of technology was used to find those milk tins in Poland where the site of that POW camp was? Because we know that that campsite had been gone over pretty well by amateurs. So how was it found?
Well, they used a technology called ground-penetrating radar, and it's a lot like the airborne radar that we're familiar with, except it's pointed down. So there's this device. It actually looks like a giant lawnmower that shoots radio waves into the ground that then reflect back up. And different kinds of materials, soil versus rock, for example, will transmit and reflect those waves differently. So when the signals come back up, the result isn't necessarily a picture of what's available underground, but trained eyes can interpret it so they know where to dig. So they might find a piece of a wall or a tunnel or some other materials underground.
Or milk tins. And they determined that these milk tins were strung together, and then someone would stand at the entrance to one of these tunnels, the Tom, Dick, and Harry tunnels, pumping bellows to pump air in. Quite something. You also talk about underwater archaeology. Jennifer McKinnon surveying the waters off Saipan in the Mariana Islands. An Allied invasion there secured a base. What did she find, and how can we connect it to, you know, to today?
She found remains of American and Japanese aircraft, tanks, landing craft. And there's one of those landing craft in particular that kind of stands out, which is an LVT. And it's an amphibious vehicle that would be used to put troops directly on the beach. And she found on one of them, and this has never been documented in any written or oral history, extra shielding around the bow and around a gun on the top. In finding this kind of battlefield modification, McKinnon's really identified a place where we can see, through the physical archaeological evidence, the kind of ingenuity and the adaptability of America's forces in the Pacific.
Well, so funny because they were retrofitting those vehicles just as we watch troops retrofit things, for instance, in the war in Iraq, you know, to give themselves more protection. These, you know, archaeological artifacts are living on while many of the people in World War II are not. You know, we're losing all the voices. So, as you say in the article, these become in some ways the voices. What else are they telling us?
Archaeology, historical archaeology of this sort, it tells us a great deal about the way that most of the people in the world, most of whom weren't soldiers, experienced this conflict in terms of their everyday lives.
Well, I'm thinking of the bomb shelters that were discovered, you know, buried under gardens in London. And, you know, inside they saw that, you know, kids that were in these bomb shelters were doing math equations on the wall, were practicing their math.
Right, right. The example you're talking about was actually one of 13 air raid shelters on the grounds of this particular school in North London. And it was sitting under a playing field and basically been untouched since the 1940s. And they opened it up and they found the stairs going down and they found this 50-foot-long space. And they found the original 1940s wiring and a fire bucket and an inkwell. And as you mentioned, they found these equations, math equations and drawings done in chalk on a wall. And it shows that students were actually studying down there. And it's really a chance you get to see, in a sense, the kind of gestures that they were making. You can almost imagine the students down there.
Right. Well, closer to home, right off the coast of North Carolina, a fishing trawler that had been rigged up as sort of a poor man's battleship was found right next to the German sub, or nearby the German sub that it had a skirmish with. They're both down there at the bottom of the sea, right off the coast of North Carolina.
Yeah, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration is working on a big project to look at the Battle of the Atlantic. And one of the surprising things that people find is just how close this battle came to those eastern shores, especially the early period where the fishing trawler you mentioned came from is something that, again, isn't well documented, because a lot of these ships were trawlers or ferries that were retrofitted, essentially, or refitted with guns so they could be deployed. And the boat in particular here, called YP-389, had basically a single non-working gun bolted to its deck, and it was sent out there against, you know, U-boats, and had to kind of hold its ground, or at least through its loss kind of teach the American Navy enough to be able to be more successful later in the war. And that's what they did. So it's kind of an untold story about how those tactics and technologies evolved.
Particularly poignant is the archaeological work that's being done at former Japanese-American internment camps. We know during World War II, thousands of Japanese and Japanese-Americans were sent to these camps, some in Colorado, and there's some excavation going on there. What are they finding?
As you mentioned, it was actually close to 100,000 people of Japanese descent were put into these camps. More than half were either gardeners or farmers from California. So one of the ways that they found to make this environment less stressful and more comforting and familiar was through gardening and farming. You know, obviously materials were very hard to come by, and so you see from the archaeology just how sort of ingenious they had to be. So in one case, they made a planter out of an old reused water pipe. And in another case, there was a piece of copper wire found, which is a very rare material during wartime, that had been used to train a Chinese elm tree, possibly as a bonsai. And then you also see that they were modifying the soil. This is the high Colorado desert. They were adding eggshell to the soil to make it more fertile.
Yeah. Samir Patel, editor of Archaeology Magazine, will link you up to the archaeology of World War II, including videos, interviews, photographs, all of that. We'll have that at hereandnow.org. Samir, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.